Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. We were scheduled in this hour to talk with Julian Zelizer. He's professor of history at Boston University, and we were going to talk about Congress and its role in the balance of powers, the relationship between Congress and the president. And we're not able to do the interview this morning, but we will reschedule this and do it on another day. Instead, we're going to play a recorded interview that we did just a couple of weeks back. The guest speaker here is Larry Cox. He's the executive director of Amnesty International USA. He was visiting the campus to give a talk, and we recorded this interview here in our studios on Thursday, April 19th. So that means that in this part of Focus 580, we will not be taking calls. In this hour of Focus 580, we will be talking with Larry Cox. He is executive director of Amnesty International USA. He's been involved with this organization for a long time, going back to 1976, when he was Amnesty's first press officer. That is, Amnesty International USA was the first press officer, went on to become the organization's first communications director, the first deputy executive director, later the deputy security general at Amnesty International's London headquarters. Then in 1990, he went on to become the executive director of the Rainforest Foundation. That's an international organization that works to protect the rights of indigenous people in the Brazilian Amazon. In 1995, he went to work for the Ford Foundation, where he traveled around the world to bolster human rights efforts in a number of places, Asia, Africa, Latin America, and Europe. And then in January of 2006, came back to Amnesty International USA as executive director. He is visiting the campus of the University of Illinois to give a talk. This is the 16th annual Daniel Sanders Peace and Social Justice Lecture. That's named for Dan Sanders, who was from 1986 until 1989, Dean of the School of Social Work. We're pleased to have Larry Cox with us here. I do want to mention here at the beginning that this is a recorded interview. We are not live as we usually are, so that means we will not be taking phone calls. Sorry for that, but because he was here, we really wanted to take the opportunity to have him in the studio and decided that we would go ahead and do this as a recorded interview. So we are very pleased to have him here on the program. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you for this opportunity.
As a very, very general question, now for someone who has been doing the kind of work that you do for something like 30, going back something like 30 years, if I ask about the state of human rights in the world today and draw some comparison between what things were like in the mid-70s, can one say that things are better, worse, maybe about the same? Wow. What would you say?
No, I think things are better. I think it's important to say that they're better because we've been fighting this battle a long time, and if things were worse after all that effort, people would wonder, well, what have you been doing? The truth is that we've won some of the most, I think, remarkable victories that the human race has ever won in the name of human rights. When I started working on human rights, there were dictatorships throughout the southern cone of Latin America. There were dictatorships in most countries in Africa and Asia. You had apartheid in South Africa. You had the Berlin Wall. You had the whole Soviet empire. You had the Gulag. All of those things have changed dramatically as a result of human rights fighters around the world in those countries. We've seen democracy reintroduced into most of those places. There are now new challenges and new problems that we face that you didn't have there before, that mainly massive human rights violations occurring in the context of armed conflict. I think, first had a reality check on how far we still had to go when we had the horrendous events in Rwanda and saw the world stand by and watch genocide take place and do really nothing to stop it. And then that was repeated in the Balkan Wars and then in Kosovo. And now we have Darfur. So clearly we have a long, long way to go. But we know from our work that in particular situations, if you can mobilize enough public pressure and public concern, public opinion, that you can literally transform the situation. And that's what we're trying to do. One new development that you'll probably ask me about, which is particularly challenging and disturbing, is the role of the United States with regard to human rights.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me take a step back. If you go back and you think about over this period of time those things that you could point to as being victories, to what extent was that the result of non-organizations like yours, non-governmental organizations, and individuals saying that human rights is something that to us is important and that when we see places where human rights are being violated, we're not just going to stand there and watch. We're going to at least say something. And to what extent or was there any degree to which actually government involvement of various governments really was important there? Or is that, do you think, more organizations like yours and individuals?
No. I would never claim that it was organizations like ours that should take the prime credit. It's a combination of factors. You need governmental power. Human rights, the Declaration on Human Rights was adopted by governments. Governments committed themselves to uphold it. And our role has been really to try to encourage governments, to use a polite word, or to force governments to live up to their own words and their own commitments. Now, when governments do that, whether it's because they have some other agenda that they're trying to advance, it doesn't matter. What matters is that when governmental power is used, it makes a huge difference in terms of saving lives, in terms of stopping abuses. And so in many of the cases that we've talked about, for example, if you take the southern cone of Latin America, the role that the U.S. government played, that Jimmy Carter played when he started talking about what was happening there, when we had a much more aggressive policy of advancing human rights. If you talk to people in the southern cone, people who were suffering and fighting on the ground, they will tell you that that was tremendously important in actually bringing those dictatorships down. And that's, again, why we are particularly concerned about the role the U.S. is playing now, because you need governments to take seriously their commitment. The power of human rights is directly related to the commitment of governments to human rights. And if that commitment is not there, there's very little that any of us can do. So we need governments to step up to their commitments, and that's most of what we do. We try to get governments to do that.
Yeah. Let me ask you to talk about one place in particular, and you've mentioned it already, and that's Darfur.
Yeah.
And I think that this, you know, given that, as you say, given that within the past couple of decades, more than that, I guess, we've had some particularly dramatic cases of genocide in the Balkans and in Rwanda, those two places you mentioned, and that I think there are a lot of people who would say we had plenty of opportunities to learn from that, and a lot of people who, after the Rwanda genocide, said we, the international community, should do everything that we can do to make certain that nothing like that ever happens again. And now here we have Darfur, and it has been going on now for a couple of years. And it seems pretty clear what's going on. Just recently, there was a story just within the past couple of days about there seems to be documented evidence that the government of Sudan is aiding the Janjaweed, and they're actually taking military planes, painting them white and painting UN on them,
yes,
to send armaments to the Janjaweed, something that the government of Sudan has steadfastly said they were not doing. The international community seems pretty well aware of what's going on there. Why is it now that after all this time, it's still going on?
Well, because you run up against the argument that's always been used by governments to defend what is indefensible, and that is national sovereignty. Mm-hmm. The Sudanese have said they don't need any help from outside to solve this problem, and they are refusing permission to allow the international community to come in and do what's really necessary if you want to save lives and stop the pillaging and destruction of villages and the rape of women, all the horrors that are going on, which is to put UN troops on the ground. And this has always been the battleground for human rights. To what extent does national sovereignty trump human rights abuses even when they reach the level of genocide? That, of course, is what gave birth to the modern human rights movement. The fact that when Nazi Germany was carrying out these acts, many governments said, well, it's none of our business. As long as it's only happening in Germany, we don't care. and the world saw what the consequences were of that. So they decided, no, that's no longer going to be the case. But in fact, ever since then, governments have still been reluctant to violate another government's national sovereignty because of fears that then somebody could come in and violate theirs. And that includes our own government, which is very worried, was very worried when the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was being formulated, that governments might come in and look at racism in the United States, look at the massive lynchings, look at the inequality, look at racial apartheid that we had set up in our education system. So all governments are very nervous and very reluctant to do what they need to do and should be done. And that's why citizen movements, unfortunately, remain the only hope we have of forcing governments to do what they are obligated to do. There's no doubt that under the UN Charter, under human rights standards and commitments, that the international community would be justified to go in even without the permission of the government of Sudan to stop this kind of these kind of massive killings and atrocities. But as you can see, the Security Council has people on it who would never allow that to happen. China in particular is very reticent to ever concede that the international community should be able to act against the wishes of a sovereign nation. That's the battle that's being fought. We're fighting as hard as we can to persuade those governments that they have to act. And it's very painful. It's very hard to watch year after year go by, not just month after month, but year after year go by in which you see the same acts going on every day and people are standing there and doing nothing. I mean, the African Union has tried to do what it can, but it's way under-resourced. You need UN troops. So we're hopeful that there's some evidence now that even China has begun to put pressure on the Sudanese. And recently, the Sudanese government announced that that it is willing to allow UN troops to come in. Now, they've done that before, and then they've changed their mind. It will take, you know, continual pressure from groups like Amnesty and other groups to make it happen. But that's the nature of the fight for human rights. It never stops. You can never give up, and you can never take a pause.
Yeah. Well, given that governments are always going to have these concerns about sovereignty, and it's not so much the case they're concerned about sovereignty of other countries, they're concerned about their own.
That's
because,
right.
As you say, they don't want somebody else coming along and saying, well, you're criticizing our record on human rights. What about your own?
Right.
And that it seems that would be sort of an insurmountable kind of hurdle, and that would mean that no matter how good the intentions were, that an organization like the United Nations, being only able to do what its member states will allow it to do, that seems that it doesn't really give them any place to go.
Well, that's why you need, as I say, that's why you need citizen movements. I mean, you need global citizen movements that pressure governments sufficiently that they feel that they're willing to give up some sovereignty. And we've seen that happen. You know, the creation of the International Criminal Court, that was also a battle over this. Should there be an International Criminal Court that can override, that can decide that a government is not bringing to justice those who are committing war crimes, and therefore the international community will bring them to justice. Now, as you may know, the United States, you know, is opposed to the International Criminal Court, fought against it, unfortunately. But nonetheless, it was created, and that was a step forward. When we finally got intervention in the case of Kosovo, albeit by NATO rather than by the UN, that was a step forward. You know, these are long-term battles to convince the human race that we need a better way to deal with these issues than simply allowing governments to do whatever they want to do in the name of national sovereignty. And I think it's a battle that in the long term can be won, will be won. I think eventually it would be necessary to really create an international policing mechanism that had a force. You know, right now the UN, every time they want to intervene, has to start from scratch to create an intervention force. But most people will recognize that when laws are broken, you need police to enforce the laws. And when international laws are broken, you need international police to enforce the laws. That's what we lack. And that's still the struggle that we're fighting. But, you know, we're going to keep fighting it until we eventually win, long after I'm gone.
I'd like to introduce again the guest for this part of Focus 580, Larry Cox. He's executive director of Amnesty International USA, visiting the campus of the University of Illinois to give a talk. He's with us here in the studio. This is a recorded interview, so that means that in this part of the show, we're not taking phone calls as we usually do. There have certainly have been American administrations, presidential administrations, who have placed a high priority on human rights. Certainly, the best known, the high point, I think a lot of people would say, was that of President Carter, Jimmy Carter. I think some people would say that at least the Clinton administration made some attempts. No administration would say that they didn't care about human rights, but certainly people have been critical of this administration particularly and said that because of the positions it has taken, it makes it difficult for the United States to argue for human rights given what we have said and done, particularly in regards to what has been called the war on terror. Is that a problem for the effort, the international effort on human rights?
I think it's the biggest problem that we face right now. The United States is not just any country. It's the most powerful country on the earth. It has a tradition of values that most people have looked to around the planet as a source of hope and inspiration. It's the largest, most powerful democracy on earth. And when that government not only carries out, commits violations of human rights, but openly and publicly defends the violation, and I would call them gross violations of human rights. These are not minor violations. These are torture. These are disappearances. These are holding people indefinitely without charges or trial. These are the kind of abuses that have normally been associated with dictatorships. And when a democracy, a powerful democracy, is doing those acts and justifying those acts, it's sending a message around the world to dictators, to tyrants, to killers, actually, that these kind of acts can be justified. If the United States justifies them, why can't we justify them? And in fact, that's what's happening in our work every day. We come across governments who are using the example of the United States to justify their own repressive policies. So it's extremely damaging. And we're at a critical moment in the fight for human rights right now, which is a moment to say, on what side is the United States going to land on this? Is it going to continue to insist that it has the right to have secret detention camps, that it has the right to hold people without charges or trial, things which violate the most fundamental ideas that on which this country was created? Or are we going to go back to at least aspiring to be a leader in the area of human rights? It's really a critical moment, and we are doing all we can to mobilize people to force their own government, their representatives, their congressmen, their congresswomen to stand up and say, this is not the America we believe in. We believe in a different kind of America, and it's time we get back to being that kind of America. But it's hard to overstate the importance of it for the entire global fight for human rights.
Yeah. How do you think about, or how would you respond to, I'm sure, that the assertion by the administration that we are at a time here where our security has been threatened in a way that it's never been threatened before?
Yeah.
And an extraordinary threat means that one must take extraordinary means to try to meet it.
Well, almost all human rights violations that have ever been carried out by any government have been carried out in the name of some extraordinary threat that had to be fought. Mm-hmm. This is the classic argument for committing human rights violations. We're threatened, therefore we throw out the rules. And in fact, the essence of human rights is that you need human rights precisely at a time when there's an extraordinary threat to guard against the natural tendency to use that threat as a justification for amassing power. I think what's happening in this country now is that people are seeing that the way we responded to what happened in my hometown of New York and what happened in Washington on 9/11, the way we responded to that has not made us safer. It hasn't protected us against more attacks. In fact, the number of terror attacks has continually increased, but in fact has made it a much more dangerous world. This is the lesson that was drawn at an earlier time when we also faced a threat. I would argue a much greater threat. You know, human rights did not come from some, you know, pie in the sky place. Human rights emerged out of World War II when people saw a real threat and realized that they needed to respond militarily, but also that we had to respond with a different idea of how human beings should live. And that's what gave birth, Franklin Roosevelt said, you know, we were fighting not just against something. It wasn't just a war against fascism. It was a war for what he called the four freedoms. And he defined freedom as the supreme rights everywhere. That's what gave birth to human rights, the understanding that if you don't protect human rights, you won't ever have security. If you get down to the level of Osama bin Laden and you're saying, well, because you violated the rights of people on 9/11, now we're going to violate rights. And Osama bin Laden said, well, no, we're going to violate rights more. I mean, you get into this insane calculation of who's going to do more damage to human beings. And so I don't think it's made us safer, these violations. I think it has totally misunderstood the way to effectively combat terror. And I think slowly but surely, after 5 years, the use of fear to try to justify these things is falling, is harder and harder to carry out. Mm-hmm. I think Americans are now beginning to understand that there's a better way to fight to make the world a safe place for everyone.
Maybe it would be worth taking a step back. I don't know if we you know, if we went out in the street and just start to stop people randomly and say to them, what would be your definition of human rights? What do you think that means? I'm not exactly sure what kind of responses we might get. We probably could get people kind of getting at what the idea is, but then it might actually be worth talking a little bit about what exactly it, when you use that phrase human rights. What exactly is it that you're talking about?
Well, it's very interesting that question because years ago when I was working with the Ford Foundation on the 50th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, we did some of that. We went out and talked with people. We did some polling, professional polling of people. And we asked them, first of all, if they'd ever heard of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And we found out that 92% of the American people had never heard of it. But secondly, then we asked people, well, what do you think human rights are? And it was very remarkable that people came up with a list which went way beyond the rights that are guaranteed by our Constitution, but were very close to the rights that are in the Universal Declaration. So in addition to the right to express yourself freely, the right not to be tortured, the right not to be killed arbitrarily, people also said, well, you know, I think we have a right to decent health care. I think we have a right to good housing. I think we have a right. And people were comfortable with that language, even though the United States as a government refuses to recognize economic and social rights. So they are what distinguishes human rights from other kinds of rights or rights that you, you know, other kinds of demands you might make for a better life. Human rights are concerned with those elements that are necessary to have to be a full human being. You know, if you take away any one of those, your dignity as a human being is severely undermined and attacked. Mm-hmm. So it's what we need to be human. There are many things beyond that that we can want and have, and we can argue about, we can talk about all kinds of other things. But human rights are the basic, essential elements of a human life. So, and if you take them away, no one can say that this is a person whose dignity as a human being has been respected. And so they're not an enormous number of them, but they're very, very basic. And I think most people actually on the earth that we've found as we go around the planet working on human rights have no trouble understanding and articulating them. It's only sort of, you know, sometimes professors and intellectuals and governments themselves who say, oh, no, we don't know what you mean by this. But I think the guy on the street knows perfectly well that if somebody's homeless, their human rights have been denied.
And do you think, I'm just curious whether you think that that cuts across people's political ideologies? And I ask the question because I would think that some people would say, well, concern about human rights, that's a liberal kind of, you know, it's liberals who are worried about that. Would you say the ability to articulate human rights and the feeling that genuinely those things are important somehow transcend people's political identification so that it, you know, that really wouldn't matter, that still there is something that is universal, that is almost that most people, no matter what they thought about other things, would essentially give you the same kind of answer?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think the emphasis might shift depending on your political ideology. I think probably, to be perfectly honest, if you know you're a Democrat or you're a liberal or progressive or whatever, you're probably more on the side of thinking that governments have a responsibility to provide health care, to provide education, to do positive acts that will benefit human beings. Whereas if you're a conservative, you're probably more concerned about governments having too much power, and so the abuse of power in terms of locking people up without proper trial or taking away their property, that's something that most conservatives feel strongly about, is the kind of human right that you're more inclined to emphasize. But I have found in my work that this is not a Democrat or Republican issue. It's an issue about how you advance those rights sometimes gets into partisan fighting. But the idea that all human beings should not be tortured, for example, I haven't found any disagreement on that along partisan lines. There are, I talk a lot about this administration and the terrible acts that have been committed in the name of fighting terror. But a lot of those acts were supported, or at least there was acquiescence on the part of Democrats in supporting that. So I don't see it as a partisan issue.
Yeah. And in fairness, I think we'd have to say that certainly there are now Republicans who have been publicly critical of what the administration has done. So I think that it doesn't break down so neatly and cleanly along partisan lines as you might think.
Yes. No, that's true. Yeah. And our job is to try to make sure that it doesn't. I mean, we spend a lot of time not just trying to talk to people who we think are already convinced, but talking to other human beings, other American citizens who may think human rights is some kind of liberal agenda, to try to talk to them about, it's really about what kind of world do you want to live in? What do you think is the role of government? Do you think government should be locking people up without ever giving them a trial? Is that really the kind of America you believe in? And we have launched this campaign called the America I Believe In campaign, which is an attempt to communicate the fundamental values that we think all Americans, wherever they are on the political spectrum, share. And we may fall short of them. We do fall short of them all the time. But as values, I don't think there are any Americans who think we should be leading the world in torture.
We are a little bit past the midpoint here. I would like to introduce again our guest, Larry Cox. He is the executive director of Amnesty International USA and has had that job since January of 2006. He has been involved with this organization actually for a long time, going back to the mid-70s when he became Amnesty International USA's first press officer. He also was the organization's first communications director, first deputy executive director, later on served at the deputy security general at Amnesty International's London headquarters. Then after that, he went to work for the Rainforest Foundation, and then after that for the Ford Foundation, working around the world to bolster human rights efforts in various places. And then after doing those things, came back to Amnesty in January of 2006 when he was named the executive director, Amnesty International USA. He's here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. We'll give a talk. This is the 16th annual Daniel Sanders Peace and Social Justice Lecture. It's a lecture that's been going on now for a number of years, named for Daniel Sanders, who was dean of the School of Social Work from 86 until 1989. This is a recorded interview, so this morning in this hour we're not taking phone calls. Is it Do you find that it's difficult to, say, persuade people, an American, that the fact that there would be prisoners of conscience somewhere else in the world, that would be something that we here in the United States should not only be concerned about, but that feel that somehow that indeed has something to do with us and with values that we consider to be important?
No, I think that has not been difficult to do. I mean, that's what, you know, that's Amnesty's trademark. I mean, that's what we do. We go into communities. We're not an organization that's made up of experts and made up of, you know, people with doctorates in human rights. We're an organization that's made up of sort of ordinary folks, so-called ordinary folks. I think some of them are extraordinary, who devote their volunteer time to get involved trying to save somebody, a case that had been given of somebody in some country that they've never visited. They don't know the language. They just know that there's a human being out there who has been unjustly treated, and that there's something they can do that will be effective in helping that person be reunited with their family. So that's never been the difficult part. I think that the more difficult part has been when the human rights violations come closer to home. That's when people start, you know, as we were just discussing, that's when people start saying, well, you know, maybe in this case I'm not so sure that I believe in human rights. I mean, you know, because I feel threatened by undocumented workers, for example. So I think maybe they should be treated harshly, or when it comes to the death penalty, for example, in the United States. Well, I do think that people should be prisoners should be killed if they've killed another human being. Those kind of debates are much harder. But Americans have a strong tendency. Sometimes it's even to an extent that you could say it's a fault of wanting to reach out to people around the world and to be an example and to draw on our values and believe that we can make not just our country better, but can make the world better. That's always been the U.S. Role.
If you, I'm interested in asking the question, do you think that there are people who, in the commonly held definition, would qualify as political prisoners being held in the United States? And I say, setting aside anything that's 9/11 related, other than that, are there, do you believe, does your organization believe that there are people who truly fit the definition of prisoner of conscience in the United States?
I think there have been very few cases that I can think of where we have felt that somebody could be called a prisoner of conscience in the United States. Mm-hmm. What we have done in the United States time and time again is called for a renewed trial. We have found some trials to be unfair, and we have called for that there should be another trial that would be fair. But, you know, there have been some cases where we have regarded people as prisoners of conscience. If they were, for example, people who did not want to serve in the military for reasons of conscience but somehow didn't meet the definition for a conscientious objector, then Amnesty would take them up as prisoners of conscience. During the civil rights movement, of course, when people were imprisoned for trying to desegregate a lunch counter, we would take up those cases as prisoners of conscience. So there have been. But I think it's one of the great strengths of this country that we have built in checks and balances in our system. And one of the things that we're so alarmed about what's happening with regard to people after 9/11 is that we have said, well, for Americans, we'll have this standard where people do get a trial. They have access to court. They can have habeas corpus. They can have these protections. But if you're a non-citizen and we pick you up, you can have none of it. And that's an extraordinary thing to be telling the rest of the world, and extremely damaging to America's reputation as a country that believes in the rule of law, and completely out of sync with the kind of values that we have ourselves fought for to enshrine in our legal system.
Mm. Now, the concern about political prisoners in other countries, it's sort of the signature issue of Amnesty. That if there's anything, you know, anything about the organization, it's that. But It is also true that if you and if people are interested in learning more about Amnesty, there's a website they can go and they can see the various issues. And there's a very long list of things. And I'm certain that over time, the list of areas in which you work has expanded significantly. Can you talk a little a bit about that and things that that now you're involved in that might not immediately come to mind for people when they hear human rights organization Amnesty International, and particularly think about the campaigns that maybe a long time ago, you know, they were involved in that did indeed involve political prisoners in other countries?
Well, I think we've always and we've remained consistent in being concerned with individual dignity and freedom. And we've always worked on the most extreme situations of the denial of the of dignity and freedom of individuals. So torture, political imprisonment are two classic cases where that's undeniable. No one can deny that if I'm arrested because you don't like what I just said on the radio and I'm put in a prison cell, that that's a denial of my rights. Similarly, when we started working on individual prisoners of conscience, we came across how many of them were tortured, and we began to work on torture. I think what's happened in the organization is that we've begun to see that there are other kinds of ways that are equally extreme violations of dignity and freedom that don't involve imprisonment. And we have begun to look at the whole range of human rights that are in the Universal Declaration, including economic and social rights. So someone who is deprived of medicine when that medicine could be made available to them and they die as a result of that, is that not as an extreme a violation of their human rights as if they were tortured? If you have children dying from hunger when there's enough food to feed them, is that not an extreme violation? So we've begun to work on economic and social rights. We also were led, I should say, because it was really the women's movement that forced us to come to grips with the way that women's rights are denied, often in situations that don't involve the government directly, but really involve their loved ones even, or people who once claimed to love them, who are now abusing them. So we began a couple of years ago a campaign on violence against women where we tried to publicize the shocking extent to which governments have allowed violence against women to be carried out without sufficient effort to stop it. And we're about to launch a campaign in this country right now on sexual violence against Native American women, which is at alarming, I mean, unbelievable rates. And has to do in part with the lack of real government commitment and resources to stop it. So those kinds of violations don't fit the sort of classic amnesty mold, but they all have in common that it's about the suffering of individual human beings caused by either government action or inaction that we think we can stop.
And so we talked a little earlier about the difficult issue of national sovereignty.
Yeah.
When you have violations of human rights going on in another country, and perhaps you go to that government and you try to put pressure on them, and essentially the government says, well, it's none of your business because this is our country and we're running it the way that we see fit, and you can just bug off. It seems that it's an even more difficult issue if what we're talking about is not national sovereignty. It's kind of cultural sovereignty. That is, it's an even more difficult issue to talk with somebody about government policy when you're talking about something that has to do with cultural values. Even more difficult to get people even to talk about it or to admit that someone from outside might have anything at all to say about that. And the way women are treated in a society are probably a pretty good example of that.
Yeah, I would say cultural values is right up there with national sovereignty as the one of the leading defenses for what is indefensible. People will always say, well, no, in our culture, we treat people like that. And we always say, well, why don't we talk to the women who are being abused in your culture and see if they really agree that, that's part of the culture? Because they don't. And they are, in fact, in every way fighting against these practices and this kind of treatment. And they it's pretty quickly established that this is not really a cultural issue. All cultures, no culture that I'm aware of, would say that would say officially that women should be beaten, for example. There are cultural battles that have to be fought, and one of the important developments in human rights work over the past several decades is the development of organizations in virtually every country, in every culture, every religion, who are raising the banner of human rights based on their own traditions and their own cultural ways of expressing those values, because they are much more effective in countering that argument than we are. If we come in, when I say we, I mean people from outside who come in. So Amnesty International is increasingly working with local women's groups in those countries who are in the lead of the fight, who are the ones who can most effectively say, you know, this is not part of our culture. This is the way that certain groups in our society have expressed that culture, have wanted to define that culture, but we don't define it that way. We don't accept that our culture allows for women to be raped or to be beaten or to be even killed, we are determined to demonstrate that. So we don't view ourselves as some kind of outside body coming in, disturbing a happy, you know, milieu where people are living differently than we think they should live. We're coming in support of people who are fighting for their very lives, often, and who don't accept that their abuse is somebody else's culture.
We have maybe about 10 minutes left in this hour of Focus 580. Larry Cox is our guest. He is the executive director of Amnesty International USA, visiting the campus here of the University of Illinois. This is a recorded interview, so again, in this hour, we're not taking calls. How do you hear? You've been involved in this work for a long time, and I'm sure that there have been, as you would say, as you have said, there are victories that you can point to, and yet enormous unmet challenges yet. How do you continue to do it day after day in the face of the enormous challenges that still remain?
Yeah, people always ask that question, and the truth of the matter is it's really there's another question, which is how could we not do it? Because when you meet people who, because of the work you have done or your organization has done, are alive and well, reunited with their families, living lives that are good, making a contribution, and they say to you, you know, I would be dead if it hadn't been for Amnesty International. They would say to you, I would have lost my mind if I hadn't been receiving letters from people all over the world saying, don't lose hope. When that happens, you think, well, you know, maybe I haven't changed the whole world. I haven't been able to stop the atrocities in Darfur. But for God's sake, I was able to do that. And how can I then turn my back on the next case? Because I know what can be done. And so I get tremendous, every day, every week, affirmation of what we can do. Every time there's a prisoner released, every time there's a law passed that may stop the violence against women, every time we manage to take a step forward in terms of stopping other kinds of abuses, I know that I can't stop doing it. That's the first answer. And the second answer is that in this work, you meet so many incredibly wonderful people. You know, it's not a drag doing human rights work. I don't want to say it's fun, but there's an element of it in which you're celebrating life. You know, you're fighting for life. You're celebrating life. You're seeing, you know, and you meet the most remarkable people. On this trip, I'm meeting, you know, young people, students here and students at other universities in the area that I've been. And they lift me up. I mean, again, you know, how could I say to them, well, I'm tired now. I'm not going to do this anymore. When they are giving their all, they don't have to do it. No, they're not being paid for it. I'm being paid to do it. They're not. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, no, it's not hard, actually.
Yeah. Just earlier, you talked at the beginning, you talked about the fact that over the time that you've been doing this work, there have been victories, certainly, and that there are new challenges all the time. And one of the things that you mentioned particularly was human rights violations that happen in and around armed conflict. And, yeah. and certainly there are places, well, Darfur would be an example. And certainly there are other places where we now have these things that now are, amazingly enough, referred to as low-intensity wars, yeah. you know, yeah. Which are still very brutal and deadly. And the thing that perhaps the way in which war fighting has changed maybe since the end of World War II is that the ratio of yeah. combatants and non-combatants, you know, who's getting killed, there are a lot more citizens, civilians, non-combatants that are being killed now. And that's in some cases, maybe that's not intentional, but in a lot of cases it is intentional. And that because of what's going on, though, in places like that here, this would be an even more difficult situation to try to get involved in. Certainly for people in non-governmental organizations that are working in places like that, people risk their lives just being there.
Yeah, no, you've put your finger on what I think is conceivably the biggest challenge that we face now for human rights. There are incredible situations. You know, you don't hear much about them because maybe the U.S. is not involved or doesn't have such a strong interest. The Congo, where millions of people have died in low-intensity warfare mm-hmm. that continues. Many other, Sri Lanka, where again, you know, hundreds of thousands of people are dying every year in this conflict. And these conflicts are everywhere. And it is extremely difficult to know how to respond effectively. It's not difficult to, you know, hold a vigil, hold a demonstration, but how do you really bring pressure to bear? And that brings us back to where we started, which is, you know, you have to be able to mobilize some kind of international police force that can stop this kind of fighting and this kind of conflicts. And it requires, you know, human rights and peace in the UN Charter are directly related. And that's usually in the sense that, you know, to get peace, you have to have respect for human rights. But it's also true that to get human rights, we need peace. So we need, you know, to bring together people who are concerned about conflict and conflict resolution and rights people working together. Because at the root of most of these conflicts are fights over rights, whether it's the right to land, whether it's the right to resources, which is partly what's fueling the conflict in Darfur, mm-hmm. the right to religious groups to have their own culture, their own lives, and it's really important that we don't get so discouraged by the seemingly intractable nature of these conflicts that we give up on them, because that's the next great test for the human race is, can we finally get to the point where we stop killing each other?
And for an organization like yours, you think that not only can you be involved in building public awareness, but actually you see yourselves being directly involved?
Well, we are directly involved in the sense of in conflicts, trying to directly intervene to get governments to come up with agreements that will end the conflict that are based on human rights. I think our involvement is more to really try, as I've been saying throughout this talk, to force governments to do what they need to do. In the case of Darfur, for example, it's very clear. We need UN troops on the ground. We need those troops to have a robust mandate that will allow them to really protect people who are under threat and to stay there long enough to negotiate a political settlement to that conflict, which is the only way any conflict can end. So I wouldn't say we're often directly involved as much as we are indirectly, but directly trying to get governments to do what they're supposed to do. Yeah.
And just finally, you in the face of this difficult challenge, you find yourself being optimistic that progress on these things can be made?
Yeah. I don't think anyone can be a human rights fighter without optimism. Mm-hmm. It's realistic optimism. You know, nobody knows better than us who read these reports day after day how far we have to go as a human race. But as I said, we see all the time victories being won. And we know it's slow. We know it's incremental. It's a long march. through history. It's Martin Luther King Jr. who said, you know, that the arc of the universe bends ever so slightly towards justice. And I think that's true. I think the human race slowly but surely moves towards the kind of world that we all want to live in. So, yeah, I'm optimistic that one day we'll live in a world where human rights are recognized and respected.
There we must leave it. If you're interested in finding out more about Amnesty International USA and you have access to the web, you can go to their website, which is www.amnestyusa.org. Our guest is Larry Cox. He's Executive Director of Amnesty International USA. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And you've been listening to a conversation that we recorded on April 19th when Larry Cox was visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. He was here to give the 16th annual Daniel Sanders Peace and Social Justice Lecture, one named to honor Dan Sanders, who was the dean of the School of Social Work here at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign from 1986 until 1989.